to notice things, to read the truth that people hid behind their eyes. His father was observing all the courtesies, but there was a tightness in him that John had seldom seen before. He said little, looking out over the hall with hooded eyes, seeing nothing. Two seats away, the king had been drinking heavily all night. His broad face was flushed behind his great black beard. He made many a toast, laughed loudly at every jest, and attacked each dish like a starving man. But beside him, the queen seemed as cold as an ice sculpture. "The queen is angry, too," John told his uncle in a low, quiet voice. "Father took the king down to the crypts this afternoon. The queen didn't want him to go." Benjen gave John a careful, measuring look.
"You don't miss much, do you, John? We could use a man like you on the wall."
John swelled with pride. "Rob is a stronger lance than I am, but I am the better sword, and Holland says I sit a horse as well as anyone in the castle."
"Notable achievements."
"Take me with you when you go back to the wall," John said in a sudden rush. "Father will give me leave to go if you ask him. I know he will." Uncle Benjen studied his face carefully.
"The wall is a hard place for a boy, John."
"I'm almost a man grown," John protested. "I will turn 15 on my next name day, and Maester Lewin says bastards grow up faster than other children."
"Well, that's true enough," Benjen said with a downward twist of his mouth.
He took John's cup from the table, filled it fresh from a nearby pitcher, and drank down a long swallow. "Darien Targaryen was only 14 when he conquered Dorne," John said. "The young dragon was one of his heroes."
"A conquest that lasted a summer," his uncle pointed out. "Your boy king lost 10,000 men taking the place. Another 50 trying to hold it. Someone should have told him that war isn't a game." He took another sip of wine. "Also," he said, wiping his mouth, "Darien Targaryen was only 18 when he died. Or have you forgotten that part?"
"I forget nothing," John boasted. The wine was making him bold. He tried to sit very straight to make himself seem taller. "I want to serve in the night's watch, uncle." He had thought on it long and hard, lying abed at night while his brother slept around him. Rob would some day inherit Winterfell, would command great armies as the Warden of the North. Bran and Rickon would be Rob's bannermen and rule Holdfast in his name. His sisters, Arya and Sansa, would marry the heirs of other great houses and go south as mistress of castles of their own. But what place could a bastard hope to earn?
"You don't know what you're asking, John. The Night's Watch is a sworn brotherhood. We have no families. None of us will ever father sons. Our wife is duty. Our mistress is honour."
"A bastard can have honour too," John said. "I'm ready to swear your oath."
"You're a boy of 14, Benjen said. "Not a man, not yet. Until you have known a woman, you cannot understand what you would be giving up."
"I don't care about that," John said hotly.
"You might, if you knew what it meant," Benjen said. "If you knew what the oath would cost you, you might be less eager to pay the price, son."
John felt anger rise inside him.
"I am not your son."
Benjen Stark stood up.
"More's a pity," put a hand on John's shoulders. "Come back to me after you've fathered a few bastards of your own, and we'll see how you feel."
John trembled. "I will never father a bastard," he said carefully. "Never." He spat it out like venom. Suddenly he realized that the table had fallen silent. They were all looking at him. He felt the tears begin to well behind his eyes. He pushed himself to his feet. "I must be excused," he said with the last of his dignity. He whirled and bolted before they could see him cry. He must have drunk more wine than he had realized. He got his feet tangled onto him as he tried to leave, and he lurched sideways into a serving girl and sent a flagon of spiced wine crashing to the floor. Laughter boomed all around him, and John felt hot tears on his cheeks. Someone tried to steady him. He wrenched free of their grip and ran, half-blind, for the door. Ghost followed close at his heels, out into the night. The yard was quiet and empty. A lone sentry stood high on the battlements of the inner wall,
his cloak pulled tight around him against the cold. He looked bored and miserable as he huddled there alone, but John would have traded places with him in an instant. Otherwise the castle was dark and deserted. John had seen an abandoned holdfast once, a drear place, where nothing moved but the wind, and the stones kept silent about whatever people had lived there. Winterfell reminded him of that tonight. The sounds of music and song spilled through the open windows behind him. They were the last things John wanted to hear. He wiped away his tears on the sleeve of his shirt, furious that he had let them fall, and started to go. "Boy!" a voice called out to him. John turned. Tyrion Lannister was sitting on the ledge above the door to the great hall, looking for all the world like a gargoyle. The dwarf grinned down at him. "Is that animal a wolf?" "A direwolf," John said. "His name is Ghost." He stared up at the little man, his disappointment suddenly forgotten. "What are you doing up there? Why aren't you at the feast?"
"Too hot, too noisy, and I drunk too much wine," the dwarf told him. "I learned long ago that it's considered rude to vomit on your brother. Might I have a closer look at your wolf?"
John hesitated, then nodded slowly. "Can you climb down, or shall I bring a ladder?"
"Oh, bleed that," the little man said.
He pushed himself off the ledge into empty air. John gasped, then watched with awe as Tyrion Lannister spun around in a tight ball, landed lightly on his hands, then vaulted backward onto his legs. Ghost backed away from him uncertainly. The dwarf dusted himself off and laughed.
"I believe I've frightened your wolf. My apologies."
"He's not scared," John said. He knelt and called out, "Ghost, come here, come on. That's it." The wolf pup padded closer and nuzzled at John's face, but he kept a wary eye on Tyrion Lannister, and when the dwarf reached out to pet him, he drew back and bared his fangs in a silent snarl.
"Shy, isn't he?"
Lannister observed. "Sit, Ghost," John commanded. "That's it, keep still." He looked up at the dwarf. "You can touch him now. He won't move until I tell him to. I've been training him."
"I see," Lannister said.
He ruffled the snow-white fur between Ghost's ears and said,
"Nice wolf."
"If I wasn't here, he'd tear out your throat," John said. Wasn't actually true yet, but it would be.
"In that case, you had better stay close," the dwarf said.
He cocked his oversized head to one side and looked John over with his mismatched eyes.
"I'm Tyrion Lannister."
"I know," John said. He rose. Standing, he was taller than the dwarf. It made him feel strange.
"You're Ned Stark's bastard, aren't you?"
John felt a coldness pass right through him. He pressed his lips together and said nothing.
"Did I offend you?" Lannister said. "Sorry. Dwarfs don't have to be tactful. Generations of capering fools in Motley have won me the right to dress badly and to say any damn thing that comes into my head."
He grinned.
"You are the bastard, though."
"Lord Eddard Stark is my father," John admitted stiffly. Lannister studied his face.
"Yes," he said, "I can see it. You have more of the North in you than your brothers."
"Half-brothers," John corrected. He was pleased by the dwarf's comment, but he tried not to let it show.
"Let me give you some counsel, bastard," Lannister said. "Never forget what you are, for surely the world will not. Make it your strength, then it can never be your weakness. Armour yourself in it, and it will never be used to hurt you."
John was in no mood for anyone's counsel. "What do you know about being a bastard?"
"Oh, all dwarfs are bastards in their father's eyes."
"You are your mother's true-born son of Lannister."
"Am I?" the dwarf replied sardonically. "Do tell my lord father. My mother died birthing me, and he's never been sure."
"I don't even know who my mother was," John said.
"Some woman, no doubt. Most of them are."
He favoured John with a rueful grin.
"Remember this, boy. All dwarfs may be bastards. Yet not all bastards need be dwarfs."
And with that, he turned and sauntered back into the feast, whistling a tune. When he opened the door, the light from within threw his shadow clear across the yard. And for just a moment, Tyrion Lannister stood tall as a king. Catelyn. Of all the rooms in Winterfell's great keep, Catelyn's bedchambers were the hottest. She seldom had to light a fire. The castle had been built over natural hot springs, and the scalding waters rushed through the walls and chambers like blood through a man's body, driving the chill from the stone halls, filling the glass gardens with a moist warmth, keeping the earth from freezing. Open pools smoked day and night in a dozen small courtyards. That was a little thing in summer. In winter, it was the difference between life and death. Catelyn's bath was always hot and steaming, and her walls warm to the touch. The warmth reminded her of Riverrun, of days in the sun with Lysa and Edmure, but Ned could never abide the heat. The Starks were made for the cold, he would tell her, and she would laugh and tell him that in that case they had certainly built their castle in the wrong place. So when they had finished, Ned rolled over and climbed from her bed, as he had 1,000 times before. He crossed the room, pulled back the heavy tapestries, and threw open the high, narrow windows one by one, letting the night air into the chamber. The wind swirled around him as he stood facing the dark, naked and empty-handed. Catelyn pulled the furs to her chin and watched him. He looked somehow smaller and more vulnerable, like the youth she had wed in the Sept at Riverrun, 15 long years gone. Her loins still ached from the urgency of his love-making. It was a good ache. She could feel his seed within her. She prayed that it might quicken there. It had been 3 years since Rickon. She was not too old. She could give him another son. "I will refuse him," Ned said as he turned back to her. His eyes were haunted, his voice thick with doubt. Catelyn sat up in the bed. "You cannot. You must not. My duties are here in the north. I have no wish to be Robert's hand. He will not understand that. He is a king now, and kings are not like other men. If you refuse to serve him, he will wonder why, and sooner or later he will begin to suspect that you oppose him. Can't you see the danger that would put us in?" Ned shook his head, refusing to believe. "Robert would never harm me, or any of mine. We were closer than brothers. He loves me. If I refuse him, he will roar and curse and bluster, and in a week we will laugh about it together. I know the man." "You knew the man," she said. "The king is a stranger to you." Catelyn remembered the dire wolf dead in the snow. The broken antler lodged deep in her throat. She had to make him see. "Pride is everything to a king, my lord. Robert came all the way to see you, to bring you these great honors. You cannot throw them back in his face." "Honors?" Ned laughed bitterly. "In his eyes, yes," she said. "And in yours?" "And in mine," she blazed, angry now. Why couldn't he see? "He offers his own son in marriage to our daughter. What else would you call that? Sansa might someday be queen. Her sons could rule from the wall to the mountains of Dawn. What's so wrong with that?" "Gods! Catelyn, Sansa is only 11, Ned said. "And Joffrey is..." She finished for him. "Crown Prince, an heir to the Iron Throne. And I was only 12 when my father promised me to your brother Brandon." That brought a bitter twist to Ned's mouth. "Brandon. Yes, Brandon would know what to do. He always did. It was all meant for Brandon. You, Winterfell, everything. He was born to be a king's hand and a father to queens. I never asked for this cup to pass to me." "Perhaps not," Catelyn said. "But Brandon is dead, and the cup has passed, and you must drink from it, like it or not." Ned turned away from her, back to the night. He stood staring out in the darkness, watching the moon and the stars, perhaps, or perhaps the sentries on the wall. Catelyn softened then, to see his pain. Eddard Stark had married her in Brandon's place, as custom decreed. But the shadow of his dead brother still lay between them, as did the other, the shadow of the woman he would not name, the woman who had borne him his bastard son. She was about to go to him when the knock came at the door, loud and unexpected. Ned turned, frowning. "What is it?" Desmond's voice came through the door. "My lord, Maester Lewin is without and begs urgent audience." "You told him I had left orders not to be disturbed?" "Yes, my lord, he insists." "Oh, very well, send him in." Ned crossed to the wardrobe and slipped on a heavy robe. Catelyn realized suddenly how cold it had become. She sat up in bed, pulled the furs to her chin. "Perhaps we should close the windows," she suggested. Ned nodded absently. Maester Lewin was shown in. The maester was a small grey man. His eyes were grey and quick, and saw much. His hair was grey, what little the years had left him. His robe was grey wool, trimmed with white fur, the stark colours. Its great floppy sleeves had pockets hidden inside. Lewin was always tucking things into those sleeves and producing other things from them. Books, messages, strange artifacts, toys for the children. With all he kept hidden in his sleeves, Catelyn was surprised that Maester Lewin could lift his arms at all. The maester waited until the door had closed behind him before he spoke.
"My lord," he said to Ned, "pardon for disturbing your rest. I have been left a message."
Ned looked irritated. "Been left? By whom? Has there been a rider? I was not told."
There was no rider, my lord, only a carved wooden box left on a table in my observatory while I napped. My servants saw no one, but it must have been brought by someone in the king's party. We have had no other visitors from the south."
"A wooden box, you say?" Catelyn said.
"Inside was a fine new lens for the observatory, for Myrrh, by the look of it. The lens crafters of Myrrh are without equal."
Ned frowned. He had little patience for this sort of thing. Catelyn knew. "A lens," he said. "What has that to do with me?"
"I asked the same question," Maester Lewin said. "Clearly there was more to this than the seeming."
Under the heavy weight of her furs, Catelyn shivered. "A lens is an instrument to help us see."
"Indeed it is."
He figured the colour of his order, a heavy chain worn tight around the neck beneath his robe, each link forged from a different metal. Catelyn could feel dread stirring inside her once again. What is it that they would have us see more clearly?
The very thing I asked myself, Maester Lewin drew a tightly rolled paper out of his sleeve. I found the true message concealed within a false bottom. When I dismantled the box, the lens had come in, but it is not for my eyes.
Ned held out his hand. Let me have it, then.
Lewin did not stir. Pardons, my lord, the message is not for you either. It's marked for the eyes of Lady Catelyn and her alone. May I approach?
Catelyn nodded, not trusting to speak. The maester placed the paper on the table beside the bed. It was sealed with a small blob of blue wax. Lewin bowed and began to retreat. Stay, Ned commanded him. His voice was grave. He looked at Catelyn. What is it, my lady, you're shaking? I'm afraid, she admitted. She reached out and took the letter in trembling hands. The furs dropped away from her nakedness, forgotten. In the blue wax was a moon and falcon seal of House Aaron. It's from Lysa. Catelyn looked at her husband. It will not make us glad, she told him. There is grief in this message, Ned. I can feel it. Ned frowned, his face darkened. Open it. Catelyn broke the seal. Her eyes moved over the words. At first they made no sense to her. Then she remembered. Lysa took no chances. When we were girls together, we had a private language, she and I. Can you read it? Yes, Catelyn admitted. Then tell us.
Perhaps I should withdraw, Maester Lewin said.
No, Catelyn said. We will need your counsel. She threw back the furs and climbed from the bed. The night air was as cold as the grave on her bare skin as she padded across the room. Maester Lewin averted his eyes. Even Ned looked shocked. What are you doing? He asked. Lighting a fire, Catelyn told him. She found her dressing gown and shrugged into it, then knelt over the cold hearth. "Maester Lewin," Ned began. "Maester Lewin has delivered all my children," Caitlin said. "This is no time for false modesty." She slid the paper in among the kindling and placed the heavier logs on top of it. Ned crossed the room, took her by the arm, and pulled her to her feet. He held her there, his face inches from her. "My lady, tell me, what was this message?" Catelyn stiffened in his grasp. "A warning," she said softly, "if we have the wits to hear." His eyes searched her face. "Go on." "Lysa says John Aaron was murdered." His fingers tightened on her arm. "By whom?" "The Lannisters," she told him. "The Queen." Ned released his hold on her arm. There were deep red marks on her skin. "Gods," he whispered. His voice was hoarse. "Your sister's sick with grief. She cannot know what she is saying." "She knows," Catelyn said. "Lysa's impulsive, yes, but this message was carefully planned, carefully hidden. She knew it meant death if her letter fell into the wrong hands. To risk so much, she must have had more than mere suspicion." Catelyn looked at her husband. "Now we truly have no choice. You must be Robert's hand. You must go south with him and learn the truth." She saw at once that Ned had reached a different conclusion. "The only truths I know are here. The south is a nest of adders I would do better to avoid." Lewin plucked at his chain collar where it had chafed the soft skin of his throat.
"The hand of the king has great power, my lord, a power to find the truth of Lord Aaron's death, to bring his killers to the king's justice, power to protect Lady Aaron and her son, if the worst be true."
Ned glanced helplessly around the bedchamber. Catelyn's heart went out to him, but she knew she could not take him in her arms just then. First, the victory must be won for her children's sake. "You say you love Robert like a brother. Would you leave your brother surrounded by Lannisters?" "The others take both of you," Ned muttered darkly. He turned away from them and went to the window. She did not speak, nor did the maester. They waited quiet while Eddard Stark said a silent farewell to the home he loved. When he turned away from the window at last, his voice was tired and full of melancholy. A moisture glittered faintly in the corners of his eyes. "My father went south once to answer the summons of a king. He never came home again."
"A different time," Maester Lewin said. "A different king."
"Yes," Ned said dully. He seated himself in a chair by the hearth. "Catelyn, you shall stay here in Winterfell." His words were like an icy draught to her heart. "No," she said, suddenly afraid. Was this to be her punishment? Never to see his face again, nor to feel his arms around her? "Yes," Ned said, in words that would brook no argument. "You must govern the North in my stead, while I run Robert's errands. There must always be a Stark in Winterfell. Rob is 14. Soon enough he will be a man grown. He must learn to rule, and I will not be here for him. Make him part of your councils. He must be ready when his time comes."
"God's will, not for many years," Maester Lewin murmured.
"Maester Lewin, I trust you as I would my own blood. Give my wife your voice in all things great and small. Teach my son the things he needs to know. Winter is coming." Maester Lewin nodded gravely. Then silence fell until Catelyn found her courage and asked the question whose answer she most dreaded. "What of the other children?" Ned stood, took her in his arms, and held her face close to his. "Rickon is very young," he said gently. "He should stay here with you and Rob. The others I would take with me." "I could not bear it," Catelyn said, trembling.
"You must," he said. "Sansa must wed Joffrey. That is clear now. We must give them no grounds to suspect our devotion.
And it is past time that Arya learn the ways of a southern court. In a few years she will be of an age to marry too." Sansa would shine in the south, Catelyn thought to herself, and the guards knew that Arya needed refinement. Reluctantly, she let go of them in her heart. But not Bran. Never Bran. "Yes," she said, "but please, Ned, for the love you bear me, let Bran remain here at Winterfell. He's only 7. "I was 8 when my father sent me to foster at the Eyrie," Ned said. "Sir Roderick tells me that there is bad feeling between Rob and Prince Joffrey. That is not healthy. Bran can bridge that distance. He's a sweet boy, quick to laugh, easy to love. Let him grow up with the young princes. Let him become their friend, as Robert became mine. Our house will be the safer for it." He was right. Catelyn knew it. It did not make the pain any easier to bear. She would lose all 4 of them then. Ned, and both girls, and her sweet, loving Bran. Only Rob and little Rickon would be left to her. She felt lonely already. Winterfell was such a vast place. "Keep him off the walls, then," she said bravely. "You know how Bran loves to climb." Ned kissed her tears from her eyes before they could fall. "Thank you, my lady," he whispered. "This is hard, I know."
"What of Jon Snow, my lord?" Maester Lewin asked. Catelyn tensed at the mention of the name. Ned felt the anger in her and pulled away. Many men fathered bastards. Catelyn had grown up with that knowledge. It came as no surprise to her, in the first year of her marriage, to learn that Ned had fathered a child on some girl, chance met on campaign. He had a man's needs, after all, and they had spent that year apart. Ned off at the war in the south while she remained safe in her father's castle at River Run. Her thoughts were more of Rob, the infant at her breast, than the husband she scarcely knew. He was welcome to whatever solace he might find between battles, and if his seed quickened, she expected he would see to the child's needs. He did more than that. The Starks were not like other men. Ned brought his bastard home with him, and called him son, for all the North to see. When the wars were over at last, and Catelyn rode to Winterfell, John and his wet nurse had already taken up residence. That cut deep. Ned would not speak of the mother, not so much as a word. But a castle has no secrets, and Catelyn heard her maids repeating tales they heard from the lips of her husband's soldiers. They whispered of Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, deadliest of the 7 knights of Aerys Kingsguard, and how their young lord had slain him in single combat. And they told how afterward Ned had carried Sir Arthur's sword back to the beautiful young sister who awaited him in a castle called Starfall on the shores of the Summer Sea. The Lady Ashara Dane, tall and fair, with haunting violet eyes. It had taken her a fortnight to marshal her courage, but finally, in bed one night, Catelyn had asked her husband the truth of it, asked him to his face. That was the only time in all their years that Ned had ever frightened her. "Never ask me about John," he said, cold as ice. "He is my blood, and that is all you need to know. And now I will learn where you heard that name, my lady." She had pledged to obey. She told him, and from that day on, the whispering had stopped, and Ashara Dane's name was never heard in Winterfell again. Whoever John's mother had been, Ned must have loved her fiercely, for nothing Catelyn said would persuade him to send the boy away. It was the one thing she could never forgive him. She had come to love her husband with all her heart, but she had never found it in her to love John. She might have overlooked a dozen bastards for Ned's sake, as long as they were out of sight. John was never out of sight, and as he grew, he looked more like Ned than any of the true-born sons she bore him. Somehow, that made it worse. "John must go," she said now. "He and Rob are close," Ned said. "I had hoped." "He cannot stay here," Catelyn said, cutting him off. "He is your son, not mine. I will not have him." It was hard, she knew.
but no less the truth. Ned would do the boy no kindness by leaving him here at Winterfell. The look Ned gave her was anguished. "You know I cannot take him south. There will be no place for him at court. A boy with a bastard's name? You know what they will say of him? He will be shunned." Catelyn armoured her heart against the mute appeal in her husband's eyes. "They say your friend Robert has fathered a dozen bastards himself." "And none of them has ever been seen at court," Ned blazed. "The Lannister woman has seen to that. How can you be so damnably cruel, Catelyn? He is only a boy, he—" His fury was on him. He might have said more and worse, but Maester Luan cut in.
"Another solution presents itself," he said, his voice quiet. "Your brother Benjen came to me about John a few days ago. It seems the boy aspires to take the Black."
Ned looked shocked. "He asked to join the Night's Watch?" Catelyn said nothing. Let Ned work it out in his own mind. Her voice would not be welcome now. Yet gladly she would have kissed the maester just then. His was the perfect solution. Benjen Stark was a sworn brother. John would be a son to him, the child he would never have, and in time the boy would take the oath as well. He would father no sons who might some day contest with Catelyn's own grandchildren for Winterfell. Maester Luan said,
"There is great honour in service on the wall, my lord."
"And even a bastard may rise high in the Night's Watch," Ned reflected. Still his voice was troubled. "John is so young. If he asked this when he was a man grown, that would be one thing, but a boy of 14.
"A hard sacrifice," Maester Luan agreed. "Yet these are hard times, my lord. His road is no crueler than yours or your lady's."
Catelyn thought of the three children she must lose. It was not easy keeping silent then. Ned turned away from them to gaze out of the window, his long face silent and thoughtful. Finally he sighed and turned back. "Very well," he said to Maester Luan. "I suppose it's for the best. I will speak to Ben."
When shall we tell John?" the maester asked.
"When I must. Preparations must be made. It will be a fortnight before we are ready to depart. I would sooner let John enjoy these last few days. Summer will end soon enough, and childhood as well. When the time comes, I will tell him myself."
Arya. Arya's stitches were crooked again. She frowned down on them with dismay and glanced over to where her sister Sansa sat among the other girls. Sansa's needlework was exquisite. Everyone said so.
"Sansa's work is as pretty as she is," Septa Mordaine told their lady mother once. "She has such fine, delicate hands."
When Lady Catelyn had asked about Arya, the Septa sniffed.
"Arya has the hands of a blacksmith."
Arya glanced furtively across the room, worried the Septa Mordaine might have read her thoughts, but the Septa was paying her no attention today. She was sitting with the Princess Marcella, all smiles and admiration. It was not often that the Septa was privileged to instruct a royal princess in the womanly arts, as she had said when the Queen brought Marcella to join them. Arya thought Marcella's stitches looked a little crooked, too, but you would never know it from the way Septa Mordaine was cooing. She studied her own work again, looking for some way to salvage it, then sighed and put down the needle. She looked glumly at her sister. Sansa was chatting away happily as she worked. Beth Cassell, Sir Roderick's little girl, was sitting by her feet, listening to every word she said, and Jane Poole was leaning over to whisper something in her ear. "What are you talking about?" Arya asked suddenly. Jane gave a startled look, then giggled. Sansa looked abashed. Beth blushed. No one answered. "Tell me," Arya said. Jane glanced over to make certain that Septa Mordaine was not listening. Marcella said something then, and the Septa laughed along with the rest of the ladies.
"We were talking about the prince," Sansa said, her voice soft as a kiss.
Arya knew which prince she meant. Joffrey, of course. the tall, handsome one. Sansa got to sit with him at the feast. Arya had to sit with the little, fat one, naturally.
"Joffrey likes your sister," Jane whispered, proud as if she had something to do with it. She was the daughter of Winterfell Stewart and Sansa's dearest friend. He told her she was very beautiful. "He's going to marry her," little Beth said dreamily, hugging herself. "Then Sansa will be queen of all the realm."
Sansa had the grace to blush. She blushed prettily. She did everything prettily, Arya thought with dull resentment. "Beth, you shouldn't make up stories," Sansa corrected the younger girl, gently stroking her hair to take the harshness out of her words. She looked at Arya. "What do you think of Prince Joff's sister?" "He's very gallant, don't you think?"
"John says he looks like a girl," Arya said.
Sansa sighed as she stitched. "Oh, poor John," she said. "He gets jealous because he's a bastard." "He's our brother," Arya said, much too loudly. Her voice cut through the afternoon quiet of the tower room. Septa Mordane raised her eyes. She had a bony face, sharp eyes, and a thin, lipless mouth made for frowning. It was frowning now.
"What are you talking about, children?"
"Our half-brother," Sansa corrected, soft and precise. She smiled for the scepter. "Arya and I were remarking on how pleased we were to have the princess with us today," she said. Septa Mordane nodded.
"Indeed, a great honour for us all."
Princess Marcella smiled uncertainly at the compliment.
"Arya, why aren't you at work?"
the scepter asked. She rose to her feet, starched skirts rustling as she started across the room.
"Let me see your stitches."
Arya wanted to scream. It was just like Sansa to go and attract the scepter's attention. "Here," she said, surrendering her work. The scepter examined the fabric.
"Arya, Arya, Arya," she said. "This will not do. This will not do at all."
Everyone was looking at her. It was too much. Sansa was too well-bred to smile at her sister's disgrace, but Jane was smirking on her behalf. Even Princess Marcella looked sorry for her. Arya felt tears filling her eyes. She pushed herself out of her chair and bolted for the door. Septa Mordane called after her.
"Arya, come back here. Don't you take another step. Your lady mother will hear of this in front of our royal princess, too. You'll shame us all."
Arya stopped at the door and turned back, biting her lip. The tears were running down her cheeks now. She managed a stiff little bow to Marcella. "By your leave, my lady." Marcella blinked at her and looked to her ladies for guidance. But if she was uncertain, Septa Mordane was not.
"Just where do you think you're going, Arya?"
the Septa demanded. Arya glared at her.
"I have to go and shoe a horse," she said sweetly, taking a brief satisfaction in the shock on the scepter's face. Then she whirled and made her exit, running down the steps as fast as her feet would take her. It wasn't fair. Sansa had everything. Sansa was 2 years older. Maybe by the time Arya had been born, there had been nothing left. Often it felt that way. Sansa could sew and dance and sing. She wrote poetry. She knew how to dress. She played the high harp and the bells. Worse, she was beautiful. Sansa had gotten their mother's fine high cheekbones and the thick auburn hair of the Tullys. Arya took after their lord father. Her hair was a lustreless brown, and her face was long and solemn. Jane used to call her Arya Horseface and neigh when she came near. It hurt that the one thing Arya could do better than her sister was ride a horse. Well, that, and manage a household. Sansa had never had much of a head for figures. If she did marry Prince Joff, Arya hoped for his sake that he had a good steward. Nymeria was waiting for her in the guardroom at the bottom of the stairs. She bounded to her feet as soon as she caught sight of Arya. Arya grinned. The wolf pup loved her, even if no one else did. They went everywhere together, and Nymeria slept in her room at the foot of her bed. If Mother had not forbidden it, Arya would gladly have taken the wolf with her to needlework. Let Septa Mordane complain about her stitches then. Nymeria nipped eagerly at her hand as Arya untied her. She had yellow eyes.
When they caught the sunlight, they gleamed like two golden coins. Arya had named her after the warrior queen of the Roin, who had led her people across the narrow sea. That had been a great scandal, too. Sansa, of course, had named her pup Lady. Arya made a face and hugged the wolfling tight. Nymeria licked her ear, and she giggled. By now, Septa Mondaine would certainly have sent word to her lady mother. If she went to her room, they would find her. Arya did not care to be found. She had a better notion. The boys were at practice in the yard. She wanted to see Rob put gallant Prince Joffrey flat on his back. "Come," she whispered to Nymeria. She got up and ran, the wolf coming hard at her heels. There was a window in the covered bridge between the armory and the great keep, where you had a view of the whole yard. That was where they headed. They arrived, flushed and breathless, to find John seated on the sill, one leg drawn up languidly to his chin. He was watching the action so absorbed that he seemed unaware of her approach, until his white wolf moved to meet them. Nymeria stalked closer on wary feet. Ghost, already larger than his litter mates, smelled her, gave her ear a careful nip, and settled back down. John gave her a curious look. "Shouldn't you be working on your stitches, little sister?" Arya made a face at him. "I wanted to see them fight." He smiled. "Come here, then." Arya climbed up on the window and sat beside him, to a chorus of thuds and grunts from the yard below. To a disappointment, it was the younger boys drilling. Bran was so heavily padded, he looked as though he had belted on a feather bed. And Prince Tommen, who was plump to begin with, seemed positively round. They were huffing and puffing and hitting each other with padded wooden swords under the watchful eye of old Sir Roderick Cassell, the master-at-arms, a great stout keg of a man, with magnificent white cheek whiskers. A dozen spectators, man and boy, were calling out encouragement, Rob's voice the loudest among them. She spotted Theon Greyjoy beside him, his black doublet emblazoned with the golden kraken of his house, a look of wry contempt on his face. Both of the combatants were staggering. Arya judged that they had been at it a while. "A shade more exhausting than needlework," John observed. "A shade more fun than needlework," Arya gave back at him. John grinned, reached over, and messed up her hair. Arya flushed. They had always been close. John had his father's face, as she did. They were the only ones. Rob and Sansa and Bran, and even little Rickon, all took after the Tullys, with easy smiles and fire in their hair. When Arya had been little, she had been afraid that meant that she was a bastard, too. It had been John she had gone to in her fear, and John who had reassured her. "Why aren't you down in the yard?" Arya asked him. He gave her a half-smile. "Bastards are not allowed to damage young princes," he said. "Any bruises they take in the practice yard must come from true-born swords." "Oh." Arya felt abashed. She should have realized. For the second time today, Arya reflected that life was not fair. She watched her little brother whack at Tommen. "I could do just as good as Bran," she said. "He's only 7, I'm 9. John looked her over with all his 14-year-old wisdom. "You're too skinny," he said. He took her arm to feel her muscle. Then he sighed and shook his head. "I doubt you could even lift a longsword, little sister. Never mind swing one." Arya snatched back her arm and glared at him. John messed up her hair again. They watched Bran and Tommen circle each other. "You see Prince Joffrey?" John asked. She hadn't, not at first glance, but when she looked again, she found him to the back, under the shade of a high stone wall. He was surrounded by men she did not recognize, young squires in the livery of Lannister and Baratheon, strangers all. There were a few older men among them, knights, she surmised. "Look at the arms on his surcoat," John suggested. Arya looked. An ornate shield had been embroidered on the prince's padded surcoat. No doubt the needlework was exquisite. The arms were divided down the middle. On one side was a crown stag of the royal house, on the other the Lion of Lannister. "The Lannisters are proud," John observed. "You think the royal sigil would be sufficient?"
But no, he makes his mother's house equal in honour to the king's.
The woman is important too, Arya protested. John chuckled.
Perhaps you should do the same thing, little sister. Wed Tully to Stark in your arms.
A wolf with a fish in its mouth, it made her laugh. That would look silly. Besides, if a girl can't fight, why should she have a coat of arms?
John shrugged. Girls get the arms, but not the swords. Bastards get the swords, but not the arms. I did not make the rules, little sister. There was a shout from the courtyard below. Prince Tommen was rolling in the dust, trying to get up and failing. All the padding made him look like a turtle on its back. Bran was standing over him, with upraised wooden sword, ready to whack him again once he regained his feet. The men began to laugh.
"Enough!" Sir Roderick called out.
He gave the prince a hand and yanked him to his feet.
"Well fought! Lew, Donis, help them out of their armour."
He looked around. "Prince Joffrey, Rob, will you go another round?" Rob, already sweaty from a previous bout, moved forward eagerly.
"Gladly."
Joffrey moved into the sunlight in response to Roderick's summons. His hair shone like spun gold. He looked bored.
"This is a game for children, Sir Roderick."
Theon Greyjoy gave a sudden bark of laughter.
"You are children," he said derisively.
"Rob may be a child," Joffrey said. "I am a prince, and I go tired of swatting at Starks with a play sword."
"You got more swats than you gave, Joff," Rob said. "Are you afraid?"
Prince Joffrey looked at him.
"Oh, terrified," he said. "You're so much older."
Some of the Lannister men laughed. John looked down on the scene with a frown. "Joffrey is truly a little shit," he told Arya. Sir Roderick tugged thoughtfully at his white whiskers.
"What are you suggesting?"
he asked the prince. "Live steel."
"Done," Rob shot back. "You'll be sorry."
The master-at-arms put a hand on Rob's shoulder to quiet him.
"Live steel is too dangerous. I will permit you tawny swords with blunted edges."
Joffrey said nothing. But a man strange to Arya, a tall knight with black hair and burnt scars on his face, pushed forward in front of the prince.
"This is your prince. Who are you to tell him he may not have an edge on his sword, sir?"
"Master-at-arms at Winterfell, Clegane, and you'll be well not to forget it."
"Are you training women here?"
the bone man wanted to know. He was muscled like a bull.
"I am training knights," Sir Roderick said pointedly. "They will have steel when they are ready, when they are of an age."
The burn man looked at Rob. "How old are you, boy?"
14, Rob said. "I killed a man at 12. You can be sure it was not with a blunt sword."
Arya could see Rob bristle. His pride was wounded. He turned to Sir Roderick.
Let me do it. I can beat him." "Beat him with a tawny blade, then," Sir Roderick said.
Joffrey shrugged. "Come and see me when you're older, Stark, if you're not too old." There was laughter from the Lannister men. Rob's curses rang through the yard. Arya covered her mouth in shock. Theon Greyjoy seized Rob's arm to keep him away from the prince. Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers in dismay. Joffrey feigned a yawn and turned to his younger brother.
"Come, Tommen," he said. "The hour of play is done. Leave the children to their frolics."
That brought more laughter from the Lannisters, more curses from Rob. Sir Roderick's face was beet red with fury under the white of his whiskers. Theon kept Rob locked in an iron grip until the princes and their party were safely away. John watched them leave, and Arya watched John. His face had grown as still as the pool at the heart of the Godswood. Finally, he climbed down off the window. "The show's done," he said. He bent to scratch Ghost behind the ear. The white wolf rose and rubbed against him. "You had best run back to your room, little sister. Septimus Mordain will surely be lurking. The longer you hide, the sterner the penance. You'll be sowing all through the winter. When the spring thaw comes, they'll find your body with a needle still locked tight between your frozen fingers." Arya didn't think it was funny.
"I hate needlework," she said with passion. "It's not fair."
"Nothing is fair," John said. He messed up her hair again and walked away from her, Ghost moving silently beside him. Nymeria started to follow too, then stopped, and came back when she saw that Arya was not coming. Reluctantly, she turned in the other direction. It was worse than John had thought. It wasn't Septa Mordain waiting in her room. It was Septa Mordain and her mother. Bran. The hunt left at dawn. The king wanted wild boar at the feast tonight. Prince Joffrey rode with his father, so Robert had been allowed to join the hunters as well. Uncle Benjen, Jory, Theon Greyjoy, Sir Roderick, and even the Queen's funny little brother had all ridden out with them. It was the last hunt, after all. On the morrow, they left for the south. Bran had been left behind with John and the girls and Rickon. But Rickon was only a baby, and the girls were only girls, and John and his wolf were nowhere to be found. Bran did not look for him very hard. He thought John was angry at him. John seemed angry with everyone these days. Bran did not know why. He was going with Uncle Ben to the wall to join the night's watch. That was almost as good as going south for the king. Rob was the one they were leaving behind, not John. For days, Bran could scarcely wait to be off. He was going to ride the king's road on a horse of his own. Not a pony, but a real horse. His father would be the hand of the king, and they were going to live in the Red Castle at King's Landing, the castle the Dragon Lords had built. Old Nan said there were ghosts there, and dungeons where terrible things had been done, and dragon heads on the walls. It gave Bran a shiver just to think of it, but he was not afraid. How could he be afraid? His father would be with him, and the king and all his knights and sworn swords. Bran was going to be a knight himself some day, one of the king's guard. Old Nan said they were the finest swords in all the realm. There were only seven of them, and they wore white armor and had no wives or children, but lived only to serve the king. Bran knew all the stories. Their names were like music to him. Serwyn of the Mirror Shield, Sir Ryman Redwine, Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, the twins, Sir Eric and Sir Arik, who had died on one another's swords hundreds of years ago, when brother fought sister in the war the singers called the Dance of the Dragons. The White Bull, Gerard Hightower, Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, Barristan the Bold. Two of the king's guards had come north with King Robert. Bran had watched them with fascination, never quite daring to speak to them. Sir Boris was a bald man with a jowly face. Sir Meron had droopy eyes and a beard the colour of rust. Sir Jaime Lannister looked more like the knights in the stories, and he was of the king's guard too. But Rob said he had killed the old mad king and shouldn't count any more. The greatest living knight was Sir Barristan Selmy, Barristan the Bold, the Lord Commander of the king's guard. Father had promised that they would meet Sir Barristan when they reached King's Landing, and Bran had been marking the days on his wall, eager to depart, to see a world he had only dreamed of, and begin a life he could scarcely imagine. Yet now, that the last day was at hand, suddenly, Bran felt lost. Winterfell had been the only home he'd ever known. His father had told him that he ought to say his farewells today, and he had tried. After the hunt had ridden out, he wandered through the castle with his wolf at his side, intending to visit the ones who would be left behind. Old Nan, and Gage the cook, Micken in his smithy, Hodor, the stable boy, who smiled so much and took care of his pony, and never said anything but Hodor, the man in the glass garden who gave him a blackberry when he came to visit. But it was no good. He had gone to the stable first, and seen his pony there in its stall, except it wasn't his pony any more. He was getting a real horse and leaving the pony behind. And all of a sudden, Bran just wanted to sit down and cry. He turned and ran off before Hodar and the other stable boys could see the tears in his eyes. That was the end of his farewells. Instead, Bran spent the morning alone in the guard's wood, trying to teach his wolf to fetch a stick, and failing. The wolfling was smarter than any of the hounds in his father's kennels,
and Bran would have sworn he understood every word that was said to him, but he showed little interest in chasing sticks. He was still trying to decide on a name. Rob was calling his Grey Wind, because he ran so fast. Sansa named hers Lady, and Arya named hers after some old witch queen in the songs, and little Rickon called his Shaggy Dog, which Bran thought was a pretty stupid name for a direwolf. John's wolf, the white one, was Ghost. Bran wished he'd thought of that first, even though his wolf wasn't white. He had tried 100 names in the last fortnight, but none of them sounded right. Finally, he got tired of the stick game and decided to go climbing. He hadn't been up in the Broken Tower for weeks with everything that had happened, and this might be his last chance. He raced across the Guardswood, taking the long way around to avoid the pool where the heart tree grew. The heart tree had always frightened him. Trees ought not to have eyes, Bran thought, or leaves that look like hands. His wolf came sprinting at his heel. "You stay here," he told him, at the base of the sentinel tree near the armory wall. "Lie down. That's right. Now stay." The wolf did as he was told. Bran scratched him behind the ears, then turned away, jumped, grabbed a low branch, and pulled himself up. He was halfway up the tree, moving easily from limb to limb, when the wolf got to his feet and began to howl. Bran looked back down. His wolf fell silent, staring out at him through slitted yellow eyes. A strange chill went through him. He began to climb again. Once more the wolf howled. "Quiet!" he yelled. "Sit down! Stay! You're worse than mother!" The howling chased him all the way up the tree, until finally he jumped off onto the armory roof and out of sight. The rooftops at Winterfell were Bran's second home. His mother often said that Bran could climb before he could walk. Bran could not remember when he first learned to walk, but he could not remember when he first started to climb either, so he supposed it must be true. To a boy, Winterfell was a grey stone labyrinth of walls and towers and courtyards and tunnels spreading in all directions. In the older parts of the castle, the hall slanted up and down, so that you couldn't be sure what floor you were on. The place had grown over the centuries like some monstrous stone tree, Maester Lewin told him once, and its branches were gnarled and thick and twisted, its roots sunk deep into the earth. When he got out from under it and scrambled up near the sky, Bran could see all of Winterfell in a glance. He liked the way it looked, spread out beneath him, only birds wheeling over his head, while all the life of the castle went on below. Bran could perch for hours amongst the shapeless, rain-worn gargoyles that brooded over the first keep, watching it all. The men drilling with wood and steel in the yard, the cooks tending their vegetables in the glass garden, restless dogs running back and forth in the kennels, the silence of the Guardswood, the girls gossiping beside the washing well. It made him feel like he was lord of the castle in a way even Rob would never know. It taught him Winterfell's secrets, too. The builders had not even leveled the earth. There were hills and valleys behind the walls of Winterfell. There was a covered bridge that went from the fourth floor of the bell tower across to the second floor of the rookery. Bran knew about that, and he knew that you could get inside the inner wall by the south gate, climb three floors, and run all the way around Winterfell through a narrow tunnel in the stone, and then come out on ground level at the north gate, with 100 feet of wall looming over you. Even Maester Lewin didn't know that, Bran was convinced. His mother was terrified that one day Bran would slip off a wall and kill himself. He told her that he wouldn't, but she never believed him. Once she had made him promise that he would stay on the ground. He had managed to keep that promise for almost a fortnight, miserable every day, until one night he had gone out of the window of his bedroom when his brothers were fast asleep. He confessed his crime the next day in a fit of guilt. Lord Eddard ordered him to the Guardswood to cleanse himself. Guards were posted to see that Bran remained there alone all night to reflect on his disobedience. The next morning, Bran was nowhere to be seen. They finally found him fast asleep in the upper branches
of the tallest sentinel in the grove. As angry as he was, his father could not help